Welcome to our deep dive. Today we're looking at an object you might know, but whose story is, pretty surprising. It's all about adaptation, rebellion, even national identity.
That's right. We're talking about Japanese Hanafuda cards.
Exactly. We've gone through articles, historical notes, all sorts of research to piece together how these, well, these simple cards really mirror Japan's social and political shifts.
Mm-hmm. We're going to unpack how these flower cards, as they mean, went from being this forbidden gambling tool to a really celebrated cultural artifact.
Yeah, tracing it from the feudal Edo period, dealing with bans, right up to, well, Nintendo.
It's quite a journey. You might find some aha moments connecting those dots.
Okay, let's jump in. The story starts, maybe surprisingly, not really in Japan, does it? Mid-16th century?
No, it starts with Portuguese traders. They brought their playing cards, their carta, over.
And those became Tensho Karuta in Japan. Heavenly cards, right?
Yep, these 48-card decks. And they got popular, like really popular, fast.
Which inevitably led to a problem.
Indeed. You have the Tokugawa shogunate in power, and they were laser-focused on political stability. They were also deeply suspicious of foreign influence.
Right. The whole Sokoku policy kicking in.
Yeah.
Isolation.
Exactly. So part of that was banning foreign goods. Playing cards got caught in that net in 1633.
And then they specifically went after Tensho Karuta.
Yeah. By 1648, the goal was clearly to crack down on all the gambling that was happening. Later on, the Kansei reforms, these were very conservative policies. They even banned Makuri Karuta, another popular card type, completely.
But, and this is where it gets really interesting, that wasn't the end of it, was it?
Not at all. It basically kicked off this centuries-long cat-and-mouse game.
Between the authorities and the card makers.
Precisely. Every time a card design got too popular for gambling, bam, it got banned. So the makers had to get clever.
Pushing them towards more abstract design.
Exactly. To try and fly under the radar.
Yeah.
That 1791 ban on Makuri Karuta was a real turning point. It forced this radical shift towards Japanese-style drawings, getting rid of numbers entirely.
And that's how Hanafuda got its unique look. All flowers and seasons, no numbers.
That's the core of it, yeah. Born out of trying to evade the law.
And those laws were serious stuff back then, right?
Yeah.
Edo period gambling laws weren't messing around.
Oh, incredibly strict. For commoners, penalties could be brutal, flogging, even execution in some cases.
Oof. But there was this one little exception, something about temples.
Right, a pragmatic one. Temple-run lotteries called tomi. They were actually legal. They were used to fund temple construction, public works, that kind of thing.
Ah, okay. So that created an opening.
A brilliant loophole. Card makers started disguising early Hanafuda decks as Utagaruta.
Poetry cards. How did that work?
Well, Utagaruta were seen as educational, useful. So they'd put intricate designs on the Hanafuda, sometimes even lines of poetry on cards like the Tanzaku strips, basically masking gambling as cultural learning. Pretty clever.
That really is ingenious, just figuring out the system.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a key moment, an innovation by a master named Yamaguchi Gisuke in Kyoto. This was during the Kansei era.
What did he do?
His Musashino cards completely ditched any hint of numbers. Instead, he used seasonal floral patterns based on this traditional aesthetic concept, Kato Fujetsu.
Flowers and birds appreciating nature.
Exactly. Because the law specifically targeted numbered cards, this was a masterstroke. It completely bypassed the regulations and really cemented that distinctive Hanafuda look we know today.
But, so, okay, fast forward a bit. Meiji Restoration, 1868. Japan starts modernizing rapidly. What happens to the cards then?
Things change. Gambling laws gradually become more liberalized. The bans start to lift. Hanafuda finally becomes, well, legal.
After centuries underground.
Right. And this legitimacy is kind of perfectly timed to the rise of a certain company.
I think I know where this is going. Nintendo.
You got it. Founded in 1889 by Fusajiro Yamauchi and its original business, producing handmade Hanafuda cards.
It's amazing to think that's where Nintendo started. But here's the really surprising twist, isn't it? Who were their biggest customers early on?
Yeah, this part is fascinating. Nintendo's early stability, its growth, it didn't just come from families playing games. A huge chunk of their business came from the very groups the authorities had spent centuries trying to suppress.
You mean the Bakudo, the professional gamblers?
Them, and also the Yakuza, the organized crime syndicates. They needed a constant supply of fresh, new decks. Why? To prevent cheating.
Yeah.
Can't have marked cards.
Wow. So it's this total paradox. The underground demand, born from the history of bands, actually provided the economic foundation for Nintendo.
It really did. That steady income allowed them to survive, grow, and eventually, much later obviously, branch out into toys and video games. Mm. Crazy path.
So Hanafuda goes from illicit to legal, even foundational for a major company. But it also became a family game, right?
Oh, absolutely. Especially around New Year's, it became a beloved tradition in many households. But its journey didn't stop at Japan's border.
Right, it traveled to Korea, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Where it became known as Watu, which means flower battle. And it got really deeply embedded in Korean culture, too. Yeah.
But it changed a bit in Korea, didn't it?
Yeah.
It wasn't just a straight copy.
No, fascinating adaptations happen. Korean Watu decks are often plastic, not the traditional paper. They usually have a red background.
Didn't they change some characters?
Yeah. The Rain Man figure, for example, was sometimes altered to remove specific Japanese historical or cultural associations. They even added Joker cards in some versions.
It really shows how an artifact can be adopted, but also transformed, made distinctively local. Cultural resilience, like you said.
Exactly. And the story still isn't over. Today, Hanafuda is still around. Nintendo still makes them, sometimes even with Mario characters on them.
Huh. Bringing it full circle, in a way. Ancient symbolism meets pop culture, and people even use them for fortune telling now.
Yeah, cartomancy.
Yeah.
Interpreting those original floral meanings, pine for luck, willow for doubt, things like that. You can even find AI Hanafuda reading apps now.
Wild. So wrapping this up, what's the big takeaway here? Hanafuda's journey is just incredible.
It really is. From Portuguese import to tool of defiance against bans, this artistic loophole, and then a cultural icon, even going global. It's a testament to human ingenuity, isn't it?
Absolutely. And cultural resilience.
And if you think bigger picture, Hanafuda shows us something important. It's like a living chronicle of how culture adapts. It survives political pressure, legal hoops, social changes.
All while kind of keeping its core identity.
Yep.
It bends, but doesn't fully break. It finds ways through the cracks.
Exactly. Strict rules, sparking creativity, underground economies, funding future giants. A simple game embodying defiance. Culture just finds a way.
So maybe something for you to think about.
Mm-hmm.
What really stands out to you about how Hanafuda managed to change so much yet endure across all that time, across different cultures? Something to ponder.